On the field, winning comes from hard work, care, and preparation. I learned that that same hard work doesn't stop when we exit the arena. Your care is our commitment, and preparation is our promise. We tackle challenges head on and turn dreams into reality, which is why I'm excited to join the team at Alcova Mortgage, where we help you score the perfect home.
Hello and welcome into the Who's On Podcast, part of the Saber Podcast Network, presented in part by Joe Reed and Alcova Mortgage. Score your perfect home today. A busy time of year for Virginia Athletics. Baseball season is winding down. Coming up later, we're going to talk to Bradley Smart, a.k.a. Friday Starters, over on X. He's from D1 Baseball, first-time guest on the podcast. We're going to talk to him about UVA, what they need to do to actually get into the NCAA tournament, a far cry from what they are predicted to do in the preseason as the preseason number two ranked team in the country, but that's coming up later with Bradley. For now, I got another first-time guest coming on to talk a little bit about Ryan Odom's European vacation as he's going international with a large chunk of this roster, a couple different names popping up in the last week, and none better to talk about it than UVA alum, a double who himself got a master's in data science from UVA. That is Nick Kalinowski. You can find him on X as Cali Drafts. Nick, how you doing, man?
Doing great. Celebrating what appears to be a great international recruiting class for Ryan Odom. Looking forward to talking about it.
This has to be something for you. You know, you do a lot of stuff with NBA draft content, scouting, but also a big FIBA enthusiast. This has to be like the perfect merging of worlds for you right now, getting these international players to come over at your school.
Yeah, so normally as a basketball content creator, the summer is a very downtime because there's not a lot of basketball going on. But what does usually happen is the big FIBA youth tournaments always happen over the summer. And so I've been tracking a lot of these guys for a while, mostly through like an NBA draft lens. But now that there's so many European players coming over to the NCAA, I'm kind of excited to see more people get more eyes on some of these guys because they are really talented.
I do want to start there because this is becoming more of a trend right now. Obviously, we're seeing UVA get more involved, and Ryan Odom, that's kind of his background. I think on last year's VCU team, he had four guys international from Utah State teams. Before that, he's had even more than that guys coming from international waters. But we're seeing this kind of throughout the college game now. I mean, you've got the whole joke with Illinois basketball right now that they're only recruiting players with each at the last end of their name. Why are we seeing so many guys come to the United States now for college basketball? Whereas before, you know, they'd stick around in the Euro leagues for a little bit and then eventually come over to the NBA draft.
Well, so what you're seeing is with NIL, a lot of these players that are in Europe, especially at the younger ages, they're mostly on amateur contracts, not fully professional. And those amateur contracts can play like laughably low amounts of money. Like Adai Mara, before he came over to UCLA a couple years ago, was getting paid about 650 euros a month to play at the top level in Spain, almost full time as a rotation player.
Wow.
And with these new NIL rules coming in, college teams can pay a lot more. And so you're seeing a lot of these more talented European guys just say, hey, you know, I know the competition level may sometimes be higher at these European levels, but I can make more money immediately if I jump over to NCAA. So it's turning into a tidal wave as we've seen this offseason.
Yeah, you started to see it over the past couple of years. You know, I can't remember all the names, but I was talking about earlier with the guy from Creighton. I don't know if you're familiar with him. Like, he had to sit out half the year because they were battling eligibility stuff, but he finally got to play. But he's like a pretty seasoned pro over there.
Yeah, from overseas. You're talking about Zubic.
Yeah, Zubic, yes. I remember it from the NCAA tournament, but also I watched, kind of listened to his story chronicled throughout the year. You've got the guy from Illinois from last season who's going to be, you know, pretty high draft pick here. I know you know all these names, but I'm just picking up on different stories throughout college basketball in the last year. But it's interesting because, you know, obviously right now it's so dominated with recruiting circles with the NIL part of this, but it's kind of a murky water, it has been for the last couple of years with NIL, because a lot of guys coming over from overseas are on different visas that are not work visas. So technically, like, there's a gray area there.
Yeah, the NIL rules around international players are a little strange. I remember Zach Edey used to always complain because, he's a
Yeah.
Canadian national, that he wasn't making as much as he was theoretically worth because he was a foreign player. What I understand is you can only get paid through NIL if you're international while you're located in your home country. So we're seeing a lot of like upfront payments or payments during the off season or things like that, because once you come over during the season, you're technically ineligible to receive that money. So there's loopholes and ways that teams are finding to get around it, but it's definitely a little more complicated.
Well, and you had an interesting thing. I remember with Oscar Tshiebwe, obviously he was making a lot of money to stay at Kentucky for that extra year, but he couldn't get NIL. So they took like an international trip and he was able to get NIL money
Yeah.
on that trip. I guess they front loaded everything and gave it to him all at one time, but some different loopholes in there. I mean, obviously, these guys aren't going to come over if they're not going to, know that they're going to get paid on the other end. So there's ways to kind of figure and sort through that. I guess just also there's this whole thing with age right now, because the teenagers seem a little bit more straightforward. But if you're 22 years old, like we're going to talk about with DeRitter later on, it's a little bit different, kind of how many years of eligibility you have and whatnot.
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of surprised when that door opened, but I think there was a player who went to BYU this past year. I don't remember his name because he didn't play that often, but he kind of broke down the door for the older prospects to come in because he was, I believe, 20, 21. And so he was older than most typical NCAA freshmen. So we were curious about how they were going to handle that case. And he ended up coming in as a sophomore and having 3 years of eligibility. And so now what you're seeing is a lot of guys 20 or even higher, like DeRitter is already 22, coming in and just basically acting like more polished JUCO transfers almost, where they're counting their
Yeah.
European experience as like a year or two of eligibility and then them coming in as juniors or sophomores and then getting 3 or 2 years, depending on how old they are.
It's a lot. It's like and you used to get like some guys that had like military service time that would come back and they're like 27 years old playing college sports for the first time or something like that. It's Man, college athletics, it's different. But I had you on because I wanted you to kind of help break down some of these players, because you've been watching some of these guys for a while now. And I want to start with the guy that actually is fully committed to UVA, the one that we've known, and that's Johan Grunloh, the German 7-footer center. Played for Rasta Vechta in the Basketball Bundesliga, teammates with our former Wahoo, Jaden Gardner. Interesting, really interesting prospect here. I know Jonathan Givony had him as probably a second round pick in the NBA draft. What can you tell us about Grunloh?
Yeah, he's a very NBA style big, obviously, which is why he was very high on Pro Prospects radars. He's a very good rim runner, super athletic, gets up and down really well. Excellent shot blocker, one of the best shot blockers in Germany this past year, only at 19 years old. He's going to get full eligibility, UVA expected. So 4 years possibly if he doesn't jump to the pros first. And he's slowly developing an outside shot. I love he has a very high release, which makes it very difficult to contest. And we saw that a lot on like pick and fade plays that they ran a lot in with the German national team or and the Rasta Vechta team in Germany. And he's slowly developing from a mid-range shooter to a three-point shooter. And once he gets to that three-point shot, he'll be a full like three-level scoring threat. And I think that'll be very difficult to cover for a lot of these power conference bigs.
And the Bundesliga, it looks like 32 threes in 28 games. That's a solid return, especially for a guy that's still working and developing that part of his game. How do you see him kind of fitting in with, I mean, we're still trying to figure out what Ryan Ohm's going to do because he's done so many different things in different stops, but how do you kind of think he fits into this college game?
So I think he's going to be more of the high pick and roll kind of big where you can do pretty much anything you want with him as a roll man. You can send him on a straight roll, a slip screen. We saw more of those fades, as I mentioned before. When they want to push the pace, he's going to be the preferred big because he can do that, get up the floor really up and down pretty easily. It's going to be very different stylistic change from what we're used to with Tony Bennett and operating in the half court. But I think it's going to be a lot more fun to watch, and a lot more fun plays are going to happen, I think, with Grunlow.
Yeah, I think as long as it works and it's winning, that's all that people really care about in the end. That's why
Yeah.
people got behind Tony Bennett and that slower pace, embrace the pace, everything. With Grenlo, he's coming in with full eligibility, so he'll start off as a freshman. How long do you kind of expect him to hang around in Charlottesville, or do you think this is a guy that could probably improve his draft stock in 1 or 2 years and maybe jump off from there?
So the fact that he was already pretty much classified in the 40s with most draft sites and still decided to come means that he would probably have to get into that top 20 range probably before he would consider leaving for the NBA. And I think he can definitely get there. It will depend on how much that shot translates over to the NCAA level and how well he's able to operate as more of like a free-flowing big as opposed to that roll man that we talked about. So we'll see. I think it will happen at some point. I think he will leave early, but I don't think you should expect him to be like a 1-year rental or anything.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we all expect him to kind of come in and make an instant impact because you look at that center position right now for Ryan Odom. Obviously, he brought in Yuga Onyensu as well, who's had varying levels of success. He had a decent year at Kentucky, then transferred to Kansas State, didn't get a lot of playing time there. But it seems like kind of it's setting up for Grunlow to kind of be the guy in that center position. Do you see him kind of, I guess, in the ACC, which I think is going to be much improved from last year, can't get much worse as it was last year. Do you see him kind of being an instant impact kind of big in the ACC?
I think so, only because from what I've seen with my analysis with transfers and international players in general, guys who tend to be great defenders tend to still be great defenders at a higher level. And Grunlow is one of, if not the best defensive big man on the international market at the moment. So I think his shot blocking will translate immediately. And as long as he can sit in the paint and block guys like Cameron Boozer from getting to the rim, I think that'll be a nice threat, a nice anchor to have at the big man position. And I think that's what they were going for with both Grunlow and Onyenso, because they've both shown excellent defensive abilities in the past. And so I think there's going to be a lot of funneling guards, drivers down to them in the middle. And they're going to be expected to protect the rim, and I think they'll do that at a good level.
I mean, that's what it seems like as far as this roster build, quick, athletic guards in the perimeter that can defend and, defend out to, 90 feet as, Ryan Odom likes to do at times in press. And then kind of funneling it in there to that one big man that can kind of protect the rim. I'm interested to see, could Grunlow, if that shot really develops, could he play next to Onyensu at times if Ryan Odom wants to go bigger for some matchups? I know he's got some smaller guys at the four position that he's going to want to play there, and he likes to keep a bunch of those guards out on the court. But I'd be interested to see if he tries that.
You, in theory, you could, because Grunlow has the mobility to play the four, I think. The question is, will he be able to fill that four role on offense? And
Yeah.
I think that will come along with the jump shot, like we specified. Pretty much in all levels of basketball these days, you probably need at least three or four consistent outside threats. They don't have to be great shooters, but they have to be good enough to for the defense to respect them. So you can get your like main post big in like one-on-one situations and spread the floor otherwise. And so if that shot comes along, absolutely, you could have him be one of the guys to play more perimeter oriented as the four.
Of the guys that Odom's brought in so far, I mean, Onyensu is really the only one that you can't see having any kind of outside shot. So I mean, he wants four, if not five, guys out there on the court that can shoot it at all times. All right, the reason that I'm having you on here, especially today, because going back through your tweets and stuff, you've been talking about Tyus DeRitter for a long time now. He's 22-year-old, 6'8", Belgian power forward, playing for Bilbao Basket in Liga Endesa, and that's in Spain. Really intriguing player. What kind of turned you on to DeRitter so early?
His FIBA junior play, he played in the U20s with Belgium, which, by the way, is not a strong basketball country. It doesn't have the heritage of other ones like France, Germany. He was easily the best player at that tournament. And he carried Belgium, which I believe is ranked somewhere in like the 30s or 40s in FIBA rankings, to upset wins over teams that were way higher. Like, I think they beat Lithuania, who was in the top 10. They beat Israel, who had Danny Wolf. He played incredibly well. He basically dragged them to the semifinals. And the only reason that they didn't win in that semifinal match is because he got injured 3 minutes into the game. So he was all over the floor. At one point, he led them in all five statistical categories. He would have been my pick for MVP of that tournament, but they gave it to the best player on the winning team, which makes sense. That's usually how it goes, but he still made the all tournament team. And he's kind of transitioned that into a very good, I want to call it club basketball career. He made the BNXT, which is the Belgium League, all league team at 19 years old. So he'd already basically surpassed that level by the time he finished his teenage years and then moved to Spain, which, for those unfamiliar with international basketball, the Spanish league is basically like the second best domestic league in the world behind the NBA. And he's transitioned that into being basically a double digit scorer for Bilbao this past year. Not the alpha like he was in FIBA play, but a solid role player for them, which is very rare at that age to do in the Spanish league.
Yeah,
So
for
I'm
sure. I
super
mean,
high on him.
you see some really high caliber NBA draft prospects that are riding the bench in the Spanish league at times before they come over. Averaged 11.6, 5.6 rebounds in the FIBA Europe Cup. You talked about the FIBA U20. He averaged nearly 17 points, 9.6 rebounds, 2.7 assists. Like those are crazy numbers for a guy, going up against, teams that are quite frankly have more talented. But and this is all coming up because obviously there's reports out there that Virginia is in good position to bring Theis deRidder over. I know he'd been recruited by Iowa and Kansas State. It seems like it's a good position. I don't want to jinx anything because you never know with the transition from international to the academic level and all that stuff, how it kind of works out. But what would this move mean for Ryan Odom and company at Virginia?
When I tweeted about him potentially coming over to America, I'd be like, he would be instantly one of the favorites to come in and be a all conference player at the power conference level. That's just how developed his game is at this point. And that's kind of what you're getting with we mentioned with the older prospects, is you're getting guys who have played multiple years at professional level, and in these super high competitive leagues. Like, I would argue that the Spanish league he may somehow be take some in some ways be taking a step down coming to at the NCAA from that league, just because it's so competitive. So he's going to come in, he's going to be able to score at all three levels. He's proven throughout different stages in his career that he's able to do different things. Like, he can be your main scorer, like in the FIBA. Then he got called up to the senior Belgian national team right after that and was more of like a catch and shoot stretch four guy. So he can do that too. Or he can be your second chance hustle, go get rebounds and put backs type guy, which is more of what he did at Bilbao this past year. So he's very versatile. He can slide in multiple different offensive roles. Not the defender that Grunlow is, obviously, but there's a lot of fun ways that you can use him.
It seems like it. I mean, just watching the highlights, I know you've watched, way more than just the highlight clips that get shared around social media and on the message boards and everything. And so that's why it's good to hear kind of what we're seeing in some of these highlights is actually kind of what plays out in the actual games and stuff. You said in your tweet, if you had a front court with Devin Tillis and Theis deRidder and, Grunlow and Onyensu, that's one of the best front courts in the ACC. We'll see if that is what comes to fruition, but why do you kind of feel like that front court would be so tailor-made to be, up in the upper echelon of the ACC?
Well, first of all, I think it's a great balance between offensive and defensive strengths. Like, you have two power forwards who are three level offensive engines, and you can switch them out, you can play together. Then you have your defensive anchors, like I mentioned before, with Grunlow and Onyenso, and that provides you a bunch of different combinations. Like the other team plays small, you can put two small guys in. If they're playing big, you can put in your two bigs. If one guy's struggling to hit a shot, you can just put in the other. It provides a lot of depth. It provides a lot of variability and strengths. There's just so many different things that you can do with those four guys, mix and match, and that's just what I love about them. And I'm really, really happy with what Ryan Odom is doing with the front court, because it didn't look like that at first. It looked like he was going
No.
on guards,
No,
but
we hadn't gotten a guy over 6'6" up until a couple weeks ago. Yeah.
yeah, he's come around really on these guys. I'm really excited.
Want to hit on a couple other guys before we get into kind of looking at the overall roster build that Ryan Odom's pulled off here. One that he had been reported he visited last week, 19-year-old Italian, Elise Asui. Is that anywhere close to the pronunciation?
Yes, Asui, or at least so they tell me in the Italian commentary. Yes.
6'7", 230 pounds, so really well built for 19 years old. I think someone was saying he's baby Zion. I think that was a thing that's going around. Plays for Varese in Serie A. Obviously Ryan Odom visited him last week. It'll be interesting to see just kind of if they bring in DeRitter, are they still a player with Asui? But in the brief in what you've seen out of him, what do you think of his game?
He's one of those guys where the body type doesn't really match how they used him last year in the Italian league. He's built like an absolute tank, which is where the baby Zion comps come from. I like Guershon Yabusele, who plays for
Yeah.
the 76ers. They're built very much the same way, very large base, broad shoulders. But they used him a lot last year as like a catch and shoot guy from the outside. And in the limited sample size, he was quite good at that. He was like 45%, I think, with Varese. But I think he's more of a redshirt candidate to me. There's a lot more aspects of his game where he needs to develop. I think he needs to use those God-given gifts and become more like the baby Zion that that has been brought upon him already. He doesn't usually like to drive and finish through contact, is one thing that I've noticed. He likes to pass it off to someone else. And I think if he used those shoulders just to go up and at least draw fouls more often, it would be a tremendous asset to him. So I think developing those nuances to his game will make him more of a power conference level guard at the moment. I don't think he's there quite yet, but he's definitely intriguing because he's got all the natural gifts.
And Ryan Odom has shown, and we'll talk about the next guy in just a second, because he follows a very similar path that you could bring some of these international guys over, have them redshirt, or maybe have them just learn for a year and then kind of bring them up through the program and stuff. And that would be an interesting add there, because if you're talking about adding a DeRitter and maybe some other players over on the perimeter, then there really isn't a need in the rotation at the moment. But if he's a guy that's willing to kind of sit and learn for a year, then I think that would be a good one. But yeah, he's being chased by a bunch of different power five schools right now, so it'd be interesting to see kind of where his recruitment ends up. But the guy I was talking about is Martin Carrere, 6'8" French forward, transferred to UVA from VCU. So he spent last year with Ryan Odom at VCU. He's known as a pretty good shooter, passer, connector type player. Played over in the French league, played for the French U18 national team. No one's seen him in a year because he's been, sitting in the shadows at VCU. But have you seen his game, and what is Virginia going to get? Again, another guy that looks kind of more developmental in this system.
I was going to say he's a little bit of a mystery man. Very little. I know very little about him outside of the very little bit he played with the U18 national team in the European tournament. And back then, it was a pretty obvious that he needed a red shirt because he was very skinny at that time. He
Yeah.
was 6'8". He's listed at 180. I'd be surprised if it's closer to like 160, 165 at that point. He was rail thin. So definitely couldn't handle the physicality of high-level college basketball, but I can't confirm this, but I assume that a year in Ryan Odom's strength and training program will have helped him to bulk up a little bit, because this guy has real stretch four potential. He was basically what they asked him to do with the U18 national team, was to basically stand around the arc, catch and shoot, fire away. And he did pretty well at that. He has a very good release, very high, tough to contest. Didn't like to drive a lot, but I think that's a lot to do with how he's built and the lack of strength there. But I think if he's made those development stages that I think he has in while out as a redshirt in BCU, I think he'll be a useful role player, at least to start out, and then eventually turn into like that Ben Vanderplas stretch four threat that UVA has likened over the years.
Hey, you don't have to threaten me with a good time with Ben Vanderplas. I think kind of towards the end of his one season with the Cavaliers, he kind of got a bad rap because there were so many different rotation questions and stuff. But I thought Ben Vanderplas was excellent in his one season with UVA and really did a lot for that program. He was one of my favorite guys to cover. We'll keep an eye on Carrere, just kind of seeing how things line up. But before we go, your overall thoughts on Ryan Odom's roster build at this point? Brought in a bunch of different transfers. He's only got one scholarship guy coming back, and that's Elijah Gertrude. Two, pretty well regarded freshmen in Chance Mallory and Silas Barksdale. So overall, just kind of what do you think of this roster at this point? With hopefully some additions coming soon, like a Tyce DeRitter.
They are going to absolutely light it up on the scoreboard. I can already tell based on these guards that they brought in. They brought in Sam Lewis, who is a absolute sniper from downtown. Dallin Hall as an experienced organizer. I think that was a very underrated addition. Didn't get as much of the fanfare as some of the other ones, but getting a guy who's experienced in the NCAA tournament and at the Big 12, which was has been among if not the best conference in college basketball the past couple of years to kind of run the show will be a solid addition and also a good mentor for Mallory, who I think is
Yeah.
going to be the point guard of the future. Devin Tillis, I think, is my favorite pickup so
Really?
far.
Okay. So I want you to explain that because a lot of people are kind of iffy on Devin Tillis, just how it translates to, the Power Five level. I've liked what I've seen on film, and obviously the stats show a good show, a story, but why is he one of your favorites coming in?
Well, because he was the main orchestrator of a high-powered offense at UC Irvine, which I think will run a very similar system to what Ryan Odom is going to want to do at UVA. And I think that since they've brought in so many other potential options, that not as much of the weight will be on his shoulders. And I think he'll be able, because of that, he'll be able to maintain that really high level of efficiency that he showed last year, where he was basically dominating the lesser Big West defenders. I don't think he'll be able to create those advantages as much, which I think is where the worries come from. But I think he'll be placed in more advantageous matchups more often because of the scheming that Odom wants to put in.
And it's going from being the guy to maybe being one of a bunch of guys. And that's kind of what this roster, how I would describe it right now, is it's a bunch of guys that are good basketball players. And there's a podcast I listen to covering the NBA, and one of the guys on there, I'll say, is the mismatch and Chris Vernon. His big thing is don't play guys who suck. And if that's what you're not, if you're avoiding playing guys that suck, you're going to be a pretty good team. If you're playing a bunch of good basketball players, that's going to pay off at the end of the day. So looking at this roster right now, we are anticipating maybe, again, not to jinx, Tyce DeRitter coming in. And kind of the two areas I laid out that I think Virginia still really wants to target is they wanted another kind of versatile forward that would be DeRitter. I think the other thing that clearly they are still going hunting after a couple different attempts, they have a large sum of money that they want to give to kind of a go-to scorer type wing player that can do a little bit on the ball, do a little bit off the ball. They've been mentioned with obviously Malik Thomas from San Francisco. That was been a while now. Desmond Claude is a new one that's kind of popped up in the last couple of weeks. His recruitment's going to be really interesting. Is there anything else you think this roster needs, or are those two areas kind of what you see Ryan Odom needing to fill out this roster?
I pretty much agree with that. I think DeRitter would be a seamless fit, as you mentioned, into that versatile forward role that they're looking for. And I love the Claude fit as well, as being that alpha dog main scorer who can attract most of the defense's attention, so you can get some of those guys like Tillis or DeRitter into more advantageous positions because he showed that he can do it at multiple Power Five schools. So I think if you get those two guys, you have a complete roster that I think is, if not the favorite in the ACC, a favorite to be competitive at the top.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I have no contradictions to those takes from you.
It's a really it's this whole offseason's been interesting. It's been kind of a slow play. They kind of had that flurry kind of near the beginning with they had like five guys in 5 days, and then it just was like complete crickets for a couple of weeks. You get the Devin Tillis one kind of trickling in there, and then all of a sudden you get these international players starting to kind of circle and pop up. But there's a lot of schools that have kind of already emptied the cupboard as far as their finances, and so for Virginia to have some left to go after, kind of some of the bigger players that are still left, it's a good position for Ryan Oden to be in. And I've been really impressed, I gotta admit, with kind of what he's done so far. I didn't have a ton of expectations because it's hard to replace an entire roster in one off season, but I think he's recovered and done a really good job. It's not the roster I think a lot of Virginia fans would have thought. A lot of people are thinking, oh, you got to have at least four guys from last year's team. Then you add some transfers in, maybe a high school guy or two, and that's it. No one's even thinking international prospects, even though Ryan Odom was almost banging us over the head telling us that he was going to look international. So, it's been a good kind of compilation of everything that Ryan Odom's done in his past.
Yeah, and it's the international prospects you have to take a very patient approach with because their season doesn't end
Yeah.
until late April, early May, right around this time of the season. So they're not really looking at next season until they're finished with their current one. Like DeRitter played in the Europe Cup, and that was a postseason tournament that went on for a pretty long time and only ended like last week. So if you weren't seeing those additions come in right away, some might get worried. I was a little worried for a second there, but there was a plan there. He was waiting for the international guys to come around, finish their season, and make his pitch then. And I think it's worked out pretty well.
It has. All right. Nick Kalinowski. Again, you can find him on Twitter, on X, excuse me, at Cali Drafts. Nick, thank you so much for coming on. Really good insight on these players. We'll have to have you on again sometime soon if we're gonna keep going this international route, man.
Yeah, thank you so much. Looking forward to it. Wahoo wah.
There you go. All right. We're going to toss it over now. Baseball season. There are only two more weekend series left to come, including a massive one over at the Dish coming up this weekend. And coming up on the second half of this Who's On podcast, we got Bradley Smart from D1 Baseball. So stay tuned.
On the field, winning comes from hard work, care, and preparation. I learned that that same hard work doesn't stop when we exit the arena. Your care is our commitment and preparation is our promise. We tackle challenges head on and turn dreams into reality, which is why I'm excited to join the team at Alcova Mortgage, where we help you score the perfect home.
Welcome back into the Who's On podcast here on the Sabre Podcast Network. Baseball season is coming down to the final stretch. Virginia with a massive series at home this week in their last home ACC series against Miami, a really hot Miami Hurricanes team. The five straight home games and finishing out the season at Virginia Tech. To hear talked about some UVA baseball and the ACC baseball as a whole is Bradley Smart. You can find him on X at Friday Starters with D1 Baseball. Bradley, thanks for coming on, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
It's a really interesting time of year, and that's why I wanted to get you on here because it's a far cry from what we thought we'd be talking about with this Virginia baseball season at this time of year. And right now, it's all about what do they need to do to get into the NCAA tournament coming down the stretch here. But before that, let's look at these kind of last final two weekends of the regular season for Virginia. Eight games left. They got a couple, midweek games left, including coming back from their finals break today as we record on Wednesday. They play Towson tonight. Going forward, though, the big ones, home series against Miami, and then they finish out the season at Virginia Tech. They have won 9 of their last 12 games, so they're starting to pick it up a little bit, but is it a little bit of a case of is it too too late in the season.
I mean, the biggest thing, and everyone talks about it this time of year, is the RPI. And that's what's really dinging them at this point. And you know, they're, I think, 72 in the RPI, 71, 72. And to get into the tournament, ACC teams generally outside the top 50, it's an uphill battle to get picked. So yeah, they're in sort of winner go home mode basically the rest of the year. And they have been playing better lately, but it's a lot needs to fall into place for them to reach.
I kind of wrote about it a couple of weeks ago, right before their series at Georgia Tech. I laid it out there for everyone just so they could see it. They couldn't afford to lose any more midweek games. They've lost so many games in the non-conference that they should have won, and that's part of the reason that their RPI is where it is, because they've lost games like that. Currently, right now, Virginia has 6 losses in the non-conference. That is the most since 2019 and 2018. They both lost 6 non-conference games in those seasons as well. Well, guess what? Those are the only 2 years in Brian O'Connor's tenure that they have not made the NCAA tournament. They've only made the NCAA tournament once when they've had more than 4 non-conference losses, and that was 2016. But to counteract that, in 2016, they were also one of the best teams in the ACC. I think they finished 3rd or 2nd that year in conference play. But you don't have that this year. It's kind of you don't have either of them right now. So that's what they're trying to do coming down the stretch here. But put it into perspective, how big is this series this weekend against Miami? And we'll talk a little bit more about the Hurricanes later and just kind of what they how they've been playing lately.
Yeah, I mean, this series is huge. I mean, if you look at the two ACC series they have left, Virginia Tech is kind of going through the same thing they've gone through each of the last 2 years, where they're ranked, they're looking really good, and then the wheels kind of fall off for all kinds of different reasons. So I think if you're Virginia, you don't look past Miami, but you feel strongly. Like, if I had to pick a winner of that series right now, I'd pick Virginia, just with how Virginia Tech has been playing. Miami's the one where they're catching Miami at the worst possible time. This Miami team right now, I saw them in person 2 weeks ago at when they swept Boston College. They're playing unbelievable baseball, just top to bottom. And so I think if you're Virginia, it's a springboard. I think if you win this series, you know, you take two or three, you're home. You feel really good going into that Virginia Tech road series, and you feel really good going into the ACC tournament. If you lose that, I mean, it's kind of dead man walking. But I do think, I think it's, yeah, it's gonna be a huge series. I think playing Miami at home is big for them. Just knowing, you know, I think fans will get out for this one, even with the season that Virginia's had. So I think it's gonna be a good one for sure.
It's the last home series of the season. It's Mother's Day weekend. It's supposed to be good weather out, so I do think it's going to be a pretty good atmosphere at the dish this weekend, especially because I think fans are starting to realize like this might be the last time we see them at home. Because normally at this time of year you're like, oh, we'll catch them in the regional and the super regional. Not this year, guys. Doesn't look like it this year. So you better catch them now, because even if they do get into the NCAA tournament, they're probably on the road. I mean, but right now I think D1 baseball, y'all put out your NCAA latest NCAA tournament projections and has UVA as one of the next 4 out, along with Virginia Tech, coincidentally, as they kind of have their backslide right now. But let's kind of make sense of this Virginia season first, and then we can kind of talk more about this upcoming series against Miami. Preseason No. 2 ranked team in the country. Texas A&M was No. 1, so not a great year for the preseason rankings, but that's what happens. I keep telling people this, like looking at everything, it wasn't like there was a lot of projection with either Texas A&M or Virginia in that matter. It was they're bringing back a lot of good players that have proven it at the college baseball level. But it's kind of a ineffable thing where you don't can't really explain what happened other than something mentally, some injuries here along the way. How would you kind of sum up what you've seen from Virginia this year?
Yeah, I mean, I think you make a really good point where A&M and Virginia, it wasn't projection. Like, yes, there's some newcomers and some freshmen that were going to play key roles. But like when you look at Virginia, you were looking at, okay, you got Becker, Godbout, Dittowick, Ford. Like you have a murderer's row type lineup just based off last year. Like 23 home runs, 17 home runs. Like you had power, you had average, you had good defense. And then we were confident enough, D1 in particular, we were confident that, there's enough depth in this Virginia staff. And that was with, Evan Blanco going out every Friday and the pressure not on Jay Woelfolk to be that Friday night guy, have him more as a two. And so also seeing someone like Chris Arroyo in the rotation, like you make some projections there, but I couldn't have seen A, Blanco hurt. So that's first off, any team that loses their top Friday arm is gonna struggle some. So you lose your top arm, and then Matt Augustine out of the bullpen, you lose your projected closer. So now your two most trusted arms, I would say, in terms of giving you length to start a game and closing out a game, they're just not there. And or if they're there, they're kind of struggling to make it back. So that, knocks down the projection a lot. And then when in conjunction with that, the lineup just limps out of the gate. Like pretty much every almost everyone, and we can talk about some of the guys that have been producing the whole year. But when you have guys like Ference and Dittowick and Luke Hansen, like just not hitting well, it's you're in trouble because your pitching staff's getting burdened already by filling innings that you thought you had settled, and then you're trying to mix and match in the lineup. And it felt like just watching some of Brian O'Connor's post game, it was like, we're trying like to figure this out. And there were moments for sure. Like I think that when they had that losing streak end in Cal, I think, and they came back and avoided a series loss. It was like, okay, that's going to be a launching point, but it's just kind of been a stop and start season for them. So it's hard. I mean, baseball at the professional level is hard to predict. It's even harder at the college level, especially when you get to the sample sizes. But yeah, it's been an interesting season for sure.
Been probably the most confusing since I've been here. And I covered both those. My first two seasons here were the 2018, 2019 teams that did not make the play. But you kind of were like, all right, maybe there's just not enough talent kind of on this roster right now to make it there. This year, it's kind of just, you can't really explain it. But yeah, looking at this lineup, you thought maybe the pitching should be good enough because you have this kind of dynamite offense that can kind of just power through anything, probably be one of the top five offenses producing in the country, like they have been for the last couple of years now. Like this has been a pretty consistent theme. They've broken the home run records every year. I remember we kind of had a fun prediction, like Virginia's only had three guys hit 20 plus home runs ever. We're like, could they have three guys hit 20 plus home runs this season? When you look at guys like Harrison Dittowick, Henry Ford, Chris Arroyo coming in, I can't. I mean, even there's a shot for Jacob Ferentz back then. And they don't even have a guy over double digit home runs at this point. Chris Arroyo leads the team with nine. So you like to think maybe he'll get to 10 by the end of the season. But yeah, it's kind of just, you can't really explain it. But with the offense not kind of producing that same way, it put a lot on the pitching early in the season, and I thought the starting pitching started off the year really well with Jay Woelfolk, Tomas Valančiūnas, the freshman, Bryson Moore back then. Here's another guy injured. Haven't seen him in a while. He kind of made a little bit of a comeback last week, but yeah, injuries have kind of nicked at this pitching staff all year. And you talk about the two big ones in Evan Blanco and Matt Augustine, obviously. But then there's Jack O'Connor, who's kind of he was started well, and then now he hasn't been in the rotation for a while. You look at just a whole bunch of guys that have kind of you thought you had something there, and then they kind of backs off. Now they've made the change to have Bradley Hodges pitch on the weekend, and I thought he looked great in his last start against Georgia Tech. So you're hoping maybe he can kind of continue with that. But yeah, the lineup, as of late, the top five in the lineup looks, I think, as strong as anyone in the ACC. It's just kind of the margins around that. Can they get anything from a James Nunnally, a Jacob Ferentz, a Trey Wells, a Luke Hansen, Harrison Dittowick? But yeah, that top five, let's start with them right now. Aiden Teel, Eric Becker, Henry Ford, Chris Arroyo, and Henry Godbout. What have you liked about kind of some of those guys' seasons?
Aiden Teal's one I just love to watch. I mean, that was a guy I was one of my favorite things to do in the preseason is to go through all of the summer league numbers and just kind of look at guys that didn't play much, went somewhere, got a lot of playing time, and did really well. And that's what Aiden Teal did, which also speaks to, the talent level of that team last year offensively, that they were like, we don't have room for you, we're going to use you as a pitcher. So I was pretty high on him coming in just with what he did in the Northwoods League. And yeah, he's been electric. I think he's one of the guys that this season could have gone way, way worse if he wasn't doing what he was doing. The move to put him up in front of Becker in the lineup was a very good move. I think they're 16-5 or something like that with him there. And then Becker's the other one where it's, following the kind of Virginia development path where it's like split time some last year with Hanson, get your, feet wet, experienced. And he's been, one of the constants. I think he's got 18 doubles, 8 home runs. So those two have been kind of going. I know Teal had kind of an up and down start, but like without those two, this team is not even close to having a chance at, a tournament run. So I've been really impressed with both of those. And it's been good to see if rounding out that five, it's been good to see Ford hitting more of what we expected him. And then Arroyo, the power is unreal. And so I'm glad he's kind of settled into that cleanup spot.
He's actually, even hit better than I thought. Chris Arroyo, he's at 314 right now. I thought he was going to be someone that was just a little below 300, but hit for a lot of power. So he's actually been a little bit more consistent at the plate than I expected. Eric Becker, like you mentioned earlier, he is by far been the most consistent, I think probably the best player for Virginia this season. And I know there's been some issues kind of fielding the ball, but you could say that for the whole Virginia defense this year. Like, it has not been a typical Brian O'Connor season. I think they are third to last in the ACC in fielding percentage right now, like, which is just mind-boggling for a Brian O'Connor team. But yeah, I thought Eric Becker has been really consistent this year, and we really have liked him, and especially now getting in that number two role. He's had some more RBI run scoring opportunities in front of him. And yeah, you talk about Aiden Teal, and I'll stop there for a second because I just put up a feature on thesaber.com about Aiden Teal and kind of his story. But waited around for 2 years to finally get an opportunity, and he has taken advantage of it this year. You mentioned 16-5 with him in that leadoff role right now. They're averaging, I think, two more runs a game with him in that leadoff role. Which I think it's like 9.2 runs, which would put them in the top 10 nationally if that was kind of how it averaged out for the season. So he's just made a massive difference, and he's such a good energy guy in the clubhouse. I mean, you can't underrate that, especially in a season like this, and especially this team, because I think early in the year, one of the big questions was, all right, you lost Griffo Farrell, you lost Ethan Anderson, you lost Casey Sauke, some guys that have played a lot of baseball for this program, but were really looked upon as big leaders in the clubhouse. What are you going to do without those guys? And I think Aiden Teal's kind of taken on that mantle as being one of the leaders for this team. Pitching wise, I think that we should probably focus in there. I guess, the starting pitching, Evan Blanco not being the ace is expected because of that preseason injury probably hurts them the most. And he's gone back into the bullpen now a little bit. They'll bring him up to, start an inning or something. They're just trying to, it seems like, get some confidence back in him because they're going to need him down the stretch. And if you can kind of use him in a bullpen role for the rest of the season, I think that would be helpful for them. But starting pitching right now on the weekends looks like it's pretty solid with Bradley Hodges, Jay Wolfhook, and Tomas Valančiūnas. We'll see if they make any more changes to that. But how do you feel about where the starting pitching is right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think Hodges gives them a shot in the arm. Getting him back and working him into the rotation. I know he was planned to be in it for that Florida State series. But yeah, 7 innings, 1 run against Georgia Tech, which has been, one of the better lineups at times. They were kind of slumping a bit there, but that's still a really impressive performance and a big one. And I've a lot of confidence in him. I think the big thing with him is he's not walking guys, like 31-9 K to walk ratio, which is good. And then yeah, I really like Valančiūnas. I think that start against NC State, where it just kind of got away at the end, was a good, a good learning experience, and B, just good to see him doing that in that environment. It's not easy to pitch as a freshman in at NC State or really anywhere on the road, but I really like him, and I think Wolfolk's probably one of the more, frustrating pitchers I've seen. I think I've seen him twice now, in person, and there's an inning where it looks like no one can touch him, or a couple innings, like against Duke, he strung together, I think, three scoreless to start, and then kind of just got into some trouble. But when he's on, he's one of the better, more consistent arms. But it's just getting a full length start out of him has been challenging. So he's a veteran, like he knows this. He's thrown a lot of college innings. So I think that's a guy that, they're hoping when the going gets really tough and it's, end of need a win, he can kind of show up like he did last year down the run.
Yeah, Wolfolk is interesting. It's kind of the similar case for most of his career, except it's been more manageable this year. But like you said, like when he's on, like he seems untouchable for like three innings, and then like you get to that fourth inning, and lets up a couple walks, some free bases out there, and then it just kind of starts to unravel on you, and like he even gets some situations where he loads the bases up and gets out of it somehow, and you're just like, all right, well. Ooh, dodged a bullet there. And that's just kind of been the theme throughout his career. I thought it's been more manageable this year. Last year, when he was going through those struggles in the regular season, it was not like you couldn't keep him out there. And that's why he kind of lost his spot in the rotation before getting it back in the postseason. But I feel kind of meh, like in the middle on Wolfolk, but I think there's some really good potential with Bradley Hodges. I mean, people forget he was supposed to be their Friday night starter last year before he got injured and had the Tommy John surgery. So, seeing him already back at this point, I really wasn't expecting much out of him this season. Like maybe just a bullpen arm just to throw out there for a couple innings, but to see him already as a Friday night starter again is way over exceeding my expectations. So we'll see how he does this week. Against Miami, but the big if you want to do like the good, the bad, the ugly has been the bullpen this year for Virginia. You mentioned the NC State game, that third game. I can't remember what the lead was, and then you look at this third game against Georgia Tech as well. It seems like you could have a 9-1 lead in the fifth inning or the sixth inning, and you're still sweating it out as soon as that bullpen comes in right now because there's just not a consistent arm out there right now.
Yeah, and that's the tough thing with college bullpens. Like, you look at the Virginia roster last year, and you had several guys that you were comfortable going to in close games, and would turn in consistent results. But this year, I think it's 15 guys have made double digit appearances, which is never a great sign, because none of them have. Only one has, I think, 20. Which is telling you look at other teams like Duke, Georgia Tech, like they have their guys. Like Duke will throw Reed Easterly and they'll be really confident in Reed Easterly. Georgia Tech will throw Mason Patel, and I don't think he had a great weekend against Virginia, but they'll be confident in him that, 9 times out of 10. Clemson has Lucas Malstedt. And when you don't have that, you just kind of get into this spiral each weekend where it doesn't happen every game, but you're gonna have games where no matter who you throw out of that bullpen, it just keeps building and building and building. And I think that's probably one of the more frustrating things for Brian O'Connor this year is not finding that guy. But I do think they have some guys I like. They have some guys I like for sure, and I think they're finding some of that mix a bit better lately. I think the bullpen ERA in April's up was up over 5, which isn't good. But like Wes Arrington, Matthew Buchanan, Matt Lanzendorfer, those are kind of seeming like solidified as the main three. So if you get their best day, that's a good group. Lanzendorfer in particular, kind of like Wolfolk, when he's on, he's real good. But yeah, I think just it's that ripple effect from not having a go-to closer where it's like you're trying your best to find one, but those roles aren't easy, especially for college arms. So I think that's the biggest thing holding them back. Obviously, as the offense has gotten going, more pressure goes onto the bullpen when you're looking at those NC State, those Georgia Tech leads. Because I think we'd be having a totally different conversation about their tournament odds if they'd won that NC State series. They'd be in much better position. But yeah, I think it's tough. It's never easy for relievers to go through that. I feel like it just kind of builds, and you get that reputation as a unit, and then it's tough to kind of dig out of.
I mean, there's a lot of series when you look back on it. I think NC State's probably the biggest regret, but there's a lot of other series. I mean, thinking back to Boston College, like there's one that they probably should have won, but they kind of the bullpen blew it towards the end in two of those games. NC State, yeah, they lost that Sunday game, and the bullpen was a big part of that. Pitt, maybe they could have swept that series, had the bullpen been a little bit better, maybe. Maybe Georgia Tech, maybe they sweep that series, and that would have done a lot for them too. But yeah, it just kind of keeps eating at them, and you almost look back at any game right now, and you're like, yeah, if they just could have gotten a little bit more. Are there any other guys that you wanted to highlight for this Virginia team that, and we don't have to be all doom and gloom. We can be a little bit more positive. I think we hit on a bunch of them. I was trying to think. Yeah, one interesting case this year has been Henry Godbout, who's before the season was quite confident in saying that he was one of the best hitters in UVA and in the ACC. He's only been at 306. He's moved down to that fifth spot in the order, just to kind of, as Brian O'Connor said, to lengthen out the lineup a little bit. But his season's been a little surprising to me, just because he's been kind of Mr. Consistent over the last couple of years.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I think that the season he's having, like 856 OPS, is not bad, but it's also not what you would expect out of him. And I think that's one of those things we talked about it earlier, where it's projection and some regression. One of the things that happens when you have a season, even a career like Henry Godbout, like you hit well as a freshman, strong start, you break out as a sophomore. You've got a lot of tape on you, and you've got a lot of teams in the ACC that have seen you and know have better ways to approach you. I think that familiarity, especially with coaches, kind of can lead to, a bit of a step back. I think I've seen this a million times where you have a good freshman year, nothing insane, but a good freshman year. You have a massive jump as a sophomore, and maintaining that, or even going beyond it, is really difficult to do. And I think we've seen that even with, Merrick Houston at Wake, where he made a to start the year huge, huge jump from his sophomore campaign. But as ACC play started, he's kind of come back down towards, he's still having, I would say, a better year, but it's teams have seen you so much that I think that might be a part of it with him. And I think two guys I have enjoyed watching is Nunnally and James, the
They're
two.
the next two on my list, so go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think Nunnally, that game he had against Georgia Tech was just like was unbelievable. But I think they both play just it just seems with like a lot of energy. And they're kind of those guys where it's like, okay, this is the guys that are gonna be everyday guys next year. Kind of the same way, you didn't have Teal playing every day last year, at all. And you had Becker in more of a split role. I think you kind of see the future some with them, and I've been impressed with both of them. And they're freshmen in the ACC. Like, you're gonna have bad games, you're gonna have bad weeks, but both of them I think have been fun to watch.
Yeah, you're gonna have bad games and bad weeks, but the most impressive part has been they have changed games for Virginia several times this season. And just to have Sean James at times this year has been kind of a breath of fresh air for this lineup. Like, there are times when they've even moved Godbout out to third base, and just to give Luke Hansen out of the lineup and maybe give him a little bit of break, and move James to second base. He's played in the outfield, he's played second base, he's hitting the DH role, played a lot of different roles, and I think he was a catcher in high school, so like he's got a lot of versatility. So I'm interested to see kind of where he fits in long term. Maybe it's probably that second base spot, but James Nunnally in the outfield. Here's a guy who's we expected to start from day one, and I think it's been kind of an up and down season for him, but his highs are have been really high for this team. You talked about that Georgia Tech game that he had. I think it was the first game, the Friday night game, where he was just automatic at the plate and really gave a big boost to this lineup. So the freshmen have been positive this year, and you throw Tomas Valančius in there too. I know he had kind of a really hot start and then kind of cooled off, but then also recently has pitched well again. So it We talked about that freshman class being really highly regarded, and we're kind of seeing why now. All right, let's get into this Miami series now. You mentioned before, and I want you to kind of talk a little bit more about Miami, because not a lot of Virginia fans have been watching a lot of ACC baseball this year. One of the hottest teams in the country. They've won 11 of their last 12. And they have not lost an ACC game since April 11th. It's the second season for JD Arteaga. What has really worked for this Miami team as of late?
Well, a couple things. So they made an adjustment, and I think that's been the biggest story for them is they came into the year with Griffin Hugues, a transfer from Cincinnati, as in the rotation, and ahead of him Nick Robert and Brian Walters, two guys that were relievers. You fast forward, you're looking up at bad start in ACC play. Robert goes down, has to have Tommy John. Walters has just not been able to maintain his velocity as a starter. So credit to that coaching staff. They're like, okay, they take two freshmen, slot them into the rotation, bump Hugues up to Friday, and move Walters back to the bullpen. And there's not one tweak that has fixed everything, because the lineup, well, I'll talk about them too, but that pitching staff has just completely turned it around. So you have Hugues, who's really a grinder on Fridays, and then Siskar and Darius are just excellent freshman arms. Then you have Walters, who, when he was a starter, he's averaging, 93, 94 miles an hour over his starts. He's now up to 97, 98, because they're just throwing him in one inning bursts, and he's 7 for 7 on saves. So that you figure out your pitching. And then at the same time, your top four in the order, I'd put him up against Virginia's guys. Because you have Jake Ogden, who gets on base a ton, plays great defense at short. Max Galvin, who had a slow start after transferring in, has been really good in the last month. Daniel Cuvée has been probably the best hitter. Actually, one other ACC hitter, Carson Tinney at Notre Dame, has been on an insane streak too. But Cuvée is probably second best, if not best, hitter in the country over the last month. And then you have Dorian Gonzalez Jr. behind him. They're a little top heavy with those guys, but those four plus that pitching has just made it really, really hard to beat them, because they don't beat themselves. They're not walking many guys. They're playing really clean defense. They're kind of doing what Virginia wants to be doing overall. And so I think it's been fun to watch them, because that was, Miami's calling for Arteaga's head. Like, their fan base is like, this is a year and a half, nothing to show for it. And now, if they win this series and they go take care of Notre Dame, they could be a host. Like, it's just crazy how quickly things can change in college baseball.
I think Virginia fans are used to that too, because like you look some past Virginia teams, that's been exactly their story. I think of the team that I covered back in 2021. Like that team was left for dead in the middle of the season, and then all of a sudden went on this great run to end the year, and they end up in Omaha after starting in the NCAA tournament on the road. It's going to be a really interesting series, and I'm intrigued. And I think Virginia, I would probably favor Miami completely. If it wasn't at home, I think that gives Virginia a shot here. But what are you looking at? What does Virginia need to do, I guess, if they want to pull this off? Because they have to pull this off if they want to, get to the postseason.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing, what I'm probably most interested to see, is how those two freshmen do against Virginia's lineup, because that's a lot of experience and veterans there. And BC has a bunch of guys that have been around as well, and Siskar cruised, but Darius kind of had some ups and downs there. And he looked sharp that third game against NC State, got rained out. Siskar threw like six one-run innings in that. So I think, because Griffin Hugues is going to battle against whoever. Like, that's just been the story of him. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if, he goes six innings, four runs allowed, like just something like that, keeps them in the game. But I'm really interested to see. I think the series might hinge on if Virginia can make those freshmen uncomfortable. Because two things with Miami: one, if the Virginia staff can hold that top four in check, there's a very steep drop off in that lineup right now. There's some guys that can hurt you, but the five guys after that, I don't think any of them over the last month have an OPS over like 600. Like,
Wow.
It's something like that, and I might have misspoke, but it's close to that. Because what keeps happening, Ogden and Galvin get on, Cuvée drives in home, Dorian Gonzalez has a big hit, or Galvin walks, Cuvée 2-run home run, double. Any kind of combination of that has been what has been the the recipe for success. And then the other point is, if Virginia can get deeper into Miami's bullpen, they should be able to have some success. Because right now, they're really not using that many guys. They're using their three starters who keep giving them 5 or 6 innings. Then they're using two or three setup guys that, like, Carson Fisher will throw twice in the weekend, probably. So they have their kind of setup guys, and then they'll go to Walters in the ninth. If Virginia can get past some of those guys, force, let's bring in a reliever that's not throwing consistently over the last few weekends. I think that's kind of the key for Virginia if they're going to pull this off.
It's an interesting matchup anytime Virginia and Miami have gone up against each other in the past. I know Miami's kind of been fluctuating in recent years, but you look at it, Virginia, outside of a sweep in 2023, so 2 seasons ago, they have not beaten Miami in a series since 2017. So there's been a lot of struggles against this Hurricanes team for Virginia. So interested to see what happens this week in Miami. Do you want to log a prediction?
I think you make a good point about betting against Virginia at home. I think Miami has the momentum for sure, but I also think it's Virginia backs against it. Like, Miami can lose this series and still be in the NCAA tournament. Like, their RPI is all the way up in the 20s. They're playing for a host role, but I wouldn't be surprised. I don't know if this counts as a prediction, but I wouldn't be surprised if Virginia wins it 2-1. Just with what they need. But that means that lineup shows up and the bullpen's able to hold them off. 'Cause I do think BC found this out twice. Like, you can hold Miami off the board. Like, you can get through those first few guys a couple times through the order. But in two of those three games, Cuvée, go ahead RBI double in the eighth, home run in the eighth at the series finale. So I think if Virginia's going to win it 2-1, bullpen needs to be able to hold it, which is stressful for sure.
Yeah, I think the key for me, and it's pretty much been the key for the last couple of weeks, is can the starting pitching get you through 6 innings? Just to hold off on having to get into that bullpen until later in the game. If they can do that, I feel a little bit better. If they can't do that, and you gotta, I think last week, Jay Wolfe got through 4 innings and they had to bring the bullpen in early, and that's when things started feeling a little iffy and sketchy down at Georgia Tech. I'm kind of on the same mindset that Virginia backs against the wall. I've learned not to bet against them when their backs are against the wall in the recent seasons. So I think something like a 2-1. I don't know which games they win. Probably they got to win that Sunday game. So I think it's like 1-1 rubber match going into Sunday. So it's gonna be a really interesting weekend in Charlottesville. That's safe to say. Last thing here is, with the new ACC tournament model, does it help teams that need to have some work to do going into the ACC tournament to make the NCAA tournament?
Yeah, I mean, I think with what we're at now, like, the latest D1 field of 64, it's 9 ACC teams. Notre Dame's in the first four out. Virginia and Virginia Tech are in the four to watch. Like, those three teams are outside the top eight in the ACC. So they've got a good chance to win that first game and then play a team, right now that'd be a Miami, a Clemson, Duke, Louisville, play one of those teams. If you got those two wins, that's two nice wins, especially, like, the worst team in the ACC by RPI is 108th in Cal, but everyone else is 50, well, outside Virginia as well, but pretty much everyone else is up there. So I think, yeah, I think the format does help. I also think the fact that it's, some of those teams higher up are more secure means it's going to be really interesting to see how, like, if it's close game late, what are they doing? But yeah, Virginia does, they need to win these series and they need to win games in Durham, for sure.
I am just so fascinated and interested in this format this year. Like it brings a little bit more excitement going into it because like the thing about the pool play was always like, all right, you lost on Monday and you're out. So you got to wait around for your game maybe on Thursday. I think like Louisville last year, like they lost on the first day and then they had their next game on the like the last day, but they were already out. So it creates kind of more excitement and kind of builds the momentum going into the ACC tournament. But Bradley, thank you for coming on the Who's On podcast. Talk a little bit about this upcoming series. I know we'll be waiting to see kind of what happens and what plays out these last couple of weeks here. But I know you've got a lot of other stuff going on because there's a lot of other good ACC teams this year that have exceeded expectations or met expectations. I know Florida State, Clemson, that was a good series a couple of weeks ago. So again, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, that'll do it for the Who's On podcast this week. Thank you again to Bradley and Nick for coming on and talking a little hoops and baseball. We will be back next week with more here on the Who's On podcast.
On the field, winning comes from hard work, care, and preparation. I learned that that same hard work doesn't stop when we exit the arena. Your care is our commitment, and preparation is our promise. We tackle challenges head on and turn dreams into reality, which is why I'm excited to join the team at Alcova Mortgage, where we help you score the perfect home.